You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 2nd of September, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. We're in a bit of a rush today. We had some technical problems, but we are here now. So how are you doing, sir?
Well, I tell you, I'm doing okay. But I don't know if you're aware of this, but some of western Pennsylvania is underwater. Parts of Johnstown, Cumbria County, dams were on the verge of cracking and breaking yesterday. I think everything's okay now, but we had some serious flash flooding yesterday.
Is that related to the hurricane that was going to the same place that Hurricane Katrina went a few years back? Is it something to do with that?
Yeah, I think this part of Appalachia is at the northern fringe of it. And it's supposed to be once in 1,000 years is one area is supposed to get this much rain at once. Western PA has tremendous flooding, flood technology. And so for that to come under strain, it was extraordinary. It was tremendous.
I didn't realize you're actually a part of Appalachia. That really sort of ties in with the subject that we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about the opioid crisis, and I know that there's a big problem with that over in Appalachia, and we're talking about it today because we've got some hot news, basically. Purdue Pharma, the maker of the powerful opioid OxyContin, will be dissolved after a federal judge approved a $4.5 billion settlement deal with the firm's owners, who will be granted immunity from future lawsuits in exchange. Judge Robert Drain of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in White Plains, New York, authorized the settlement on Wednesday, forcing the Sackler family, which owns Purdue, to shell out more than $4 billion and dissolve the company after a flurry of lawsuits linked to OxyContin and its role in America's opioid crisis. "This is a bitter result," Drain said of the deal, which released the Sacklers from any future liability in opioid-related civil cases. The judge noted that Purdue's products had contributed to a massive public health crisis that has led to hundreds of thousands of overdose deaths and a wave of addiction, and voiced frustration that large amounts of the Sacklers' family fortune is stored in offshore accounts. The U.S. Department of Justice, along with attorneys general for 9 states and Washington, D.C., vocally opposed the settlement plan, with the Department of Justice filing a series of briefs in recent weeks urging Drain to reject the deal. "Due process requires that those with litigation claims have reasonable opportunity to be heard," DOJ lawyer Paul Schwartzberg argued during the trial. Opponents also insisted the $4.5 billion settlement amounted to a slap on the wrist for the wealthy Sacklers, who reportedly raked in some $10 billion from Purdue between 2008 and 2017. A congressional committee probing the family earlier this year, moreover, estimated it had a combined worth of around $11 billion. Several states have already signaled plans to appeal the decision, including the Attorney General for Washington State, Bob Ferguson, who blasted the settlement as morally and legally bankrupt, arguing that it allows the Sacklers to walk away as billionaires with a lifetime legal shield. Now, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. They've been fined half of all their profits. And, you know, am I wrong? Are you thinking that seems pretty reasonable? Half of all the profits from their, their medical company, they've actually paid in a settlement here. But obviously, people are saying this is not right. This is just a slap on the wrist. So, how do we justify the two here, Matt? Because it looks to me like they've taken 50% of everything here. But what are your thoughts on it?
Well, first of all, I guarantee you, I guarantee you, I will bet everything I have that this family has property in Israel that it's going to be running to if they're not there already. The second thing is we're not quite sure how much they're worth because so much of their cash is in other things, is abroad. I guarantee you, as Israeli investments around the planet, you know, things like art and God knows what else. The third thing is I don't think it's so much the amount of money. It's the fact that they're now immune from lawsuits from here on in. And they came out and said, we're not going to take this settlement unless you grant us full immunity. I think that's what's really bothering them. The money, yeah, it's kind of makes a dent. If you remember, their personal property as well as the company property, they're worth billions more than what the company's worth personally. And they have been taking money out of their company and putting it elsewhere in anticipation of this. But I think it's the immunity. It's sort of like the vaccine companies making sure that no one can sue them. This is what these guys are doing now. They'll pay this money. We'll probably skip town, but you can't come after us in the future. I think that's what people are upset about.
It's interesting you point out the fact that you know they probably got property in Israel because it was the same thing with the opioid wars in China, wasn't it? It was wealthy Jews that were responsible for that. I'm trying to think of the name of them. What's the name of them, Matt? It always reminds me of a perfume company.
Yeah, the Sassoon.
Sassoons, that's it. The Sassoons were involved back then and using the British Empire to enforce this. And today it's the same thing. We've got another Jewish family that are involved in this. Going back to the article here, Purdue, the company itself, has failed to pay compensation or rebates, as they call it. In November 2020, consultancy firm McKinsey suggested its client, Purdue Pharma, pay rebates to distributors of OxyContin for every overdose case that could be traced to abuse of the opioid pill as part of its plan to turbocharge sales. The suggestion was discovered by the New York Times in court documents last year, which were released under a Purdue Pharma bankruptcy process. The big pharma firm agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges involving its aggressive push of its dangerous product, which contributed to the opioid health crisis in the US. It is reported that in a 2017 presentation, McKinsey laid out several suggestions for boosting sales of the pill, including by compensating distributors for the damage done by selling the product. It estimated the number of people who may overdose or get hooked on OxyContin and suggested paying rebates for events that could be reliably attributed to it. For example, the report explains a rebate of $14,000, $810, for each of the 2,484 cases which the consultancy firm projected would happen in 2019 due to the OxyContin sold through CVS Health's pharmacy chain would net the distributor $36.8 million. CVS and another firm mentioned in the presentation, Anthem, are among McKinsey's biggest clients. Both companies said they never received any rebates under a scheme described in the court papers. It is said that senior McKinsey partners also discussed in 2018 doing more than eliminating all our documents and emails. The suggestion was reportedly floated by Martin Elling, a leader for McKinsey's North American pharmaceutical practice, in response to the news that the state of Massachusetts had sued a former Purdue board member for her role in fueling the opioid crisis. Elling's addressee, Arnab Ghatak, responded as quoted, "Thanks for the heads up, will do." It's not clear if any records were actually destroyed by McKinsey. So this tells us that they knew that their product was causing addiction problems. People were abusing it. And what they were going to do is they were going to pay out to the pharmaceutical chains that were selling it, the chemists that were selling it. There's no mention here of them actually paying out to the families of the victims. I mean, I'm sure they would be, quite happy to get $14,000 at least for their family member that has died due to an overdose because of this. But they were talking about basically bribing the chemists here. Is that really what's going on here, Matt?
Yeah, McKinsey is a market research firm, and they're hired by big companies to figure out how to put together a marketing plan, all kinds of strategies. One problem is that McKinsey works with the big pharmacy chains as well as Purdue Pharma. So they're working both sides. But the initial reason for these so-called rebates was to counteract the negative press that the drug had received over the years. And so it was to, you know, soothe any kind of conscience amongst, you know, CVS, Walgreens, the other people that they're working for. They claimed to never have received them. It's not really that much money. But this was a way to, okay, you're not losing anything. You can't get any kind of trouble. We'll compensate you so long as you keep selling it. And because it exploded about 10 years ago, they were in no position to say no to it. And that's what these rebates are. It's a strange thing. But it never went to the families. It went to CVS and similar companies and Anthem, which is a health insurer. So, and then, of course, on top of it, once that was, you know, it leaked out during the bankruptcy, it also leaked out that just before then, McKinsey was under orders to destroy all of these records. They absolutely knew it was a problem. They knew what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing with the rebates were illegal because it's called a kickback. And there's a kickback law in New York, a few other places, that they can now come under. I'm not 100% sure of what McKinsey's status is, but they're in a lot of trouble. But again, it's going to cost the Justice Department a small fortune, whether it be New York State or the federal government, to bring these people to heel.
Well, it also looks like they've been hiding the proceeds. In September 2019, New York's Attorney General uncovered over $1 billion in wire transfers from the Sackler family and accused the OxyContin magnates of trying to shield their wealth from mounting lawsuits over their role in the opioid crisis. The prodigious stash was discovered in the records of just one of the 33 financial institutions Attorney General Letitia James subpoenaed in an effort to trace the extent of the Purdue Pharma owner's wealth, James's office said at the time. The money passed through several Swiss bank accounts, indicating the family may have tried to hide profits from the sale of drugs that have killed hundreds of thousands of Americans over the past two decades as their legal troubles began to pile up. While the Sacklers continue to lowball victims and skirt a responsible settlement, we refuse to allow the family to misuse the courts in an effort to shield their financial misconduct, James said in a statement referring to the tentative $3 billion settlement 23 states reached with the Sacklers last year. The money would be paid out over 7 years and would not come within any admission of wrongdoing. The proposed settlement, which rolls together nearly 2,300 lawsuits against the company, would require Purdue Pharma to file for bankruptcy, a move that would halt all litigation against the company. New York and many other states are hoping to reclaim the profits the Sacklers may have siphoned off into their personal fortunes, and legal experts who spoke to the New York Times suggested the extent of the transfers could leave the family open to criminal charges. State attorney generals who opposed the deal want the Sacklers to pay the massive bills governments have spent in treatment and incarceration, as well as compensation for the deaths caused by Purdue's blockbuster opioid OxyContin. Introduced in 1996 and pushed heavily with the help of a marketing campaign that included co-opting medical authorities into emphasizing pain relief whilst downplaying or even denying the drug's addiction potential. Those who supported the settlement, however, prefer the comparatively diminutive payout to the uncertainty of long, drawn-out legal processes. Now, I've probably got a bit of a different opinion to most on this, and it relies on this difference between addiction and dependence. I think all opioid drugs are dependency-inducing, and people will become dependent on them, but the actual number of people that do become addicted is actually very small. But people get addiction mixed up with dependence, and people that start taking this OxyContin, if they think they're going to be able to give it up, they're not going to be able to give it up because they're going to be dependent on it. And of course, then it looks like they're addicted and the doctor stops them from taking it. And then they go out and they buy the illegal drugs and they end up having an overdose and they end up dying. And that's where all these deaths actually come from. I think it's a problem with underprescribing rather than overprescribing, and the people that really end up suffering from all of this are the people that suffer with acute pain, because they now have problems with actually getting pain relief because the doctors are all concerned that they're all going to become addicted, so that they're not actually giving out enough pain relief for these patients. And it's all down to this. It's down to this promotion of this as not being addictive, and hiding the fact that it is actually dependency inducing. So that's my views on this, Matt. But what are yours?
Well, there are probably very few of us who haven't had legitimate reasons to take a painkiller. I've had root canals, kidney stones, where the painkillers were absolutely essential. They're fast acting, but of course they create dependency. Anything you take, I mean, I have a dependency to food too. But I think the difference is dependency is psychological. Addiction is physical. You know, a true alcoholic is someone, when you take that alcohol away, he's going to go into convulsions and he's going to die. That's not the same. You mean you take like nicotine is you get dependent on it. You get very unhappy when you get it taken away, but you're not going to have a heart attack. And the drug rehabilitation industry doesn't make that distinction between physical and psychological addictions or dependencies. They treat it all as one thing. I've never come across a doctor that was very pleased to give a prescription to any opioid. I've taken it twice in my life, those two events. And even you take a couple of them and the mood goes up and down. You really feel it badly. And I think the addiction potential is that when you take it for a week, it takes the pain away. You go off it, you get into a very bad mood very quickly. And that's one thing you want to reach for. I think that's the origin of this. It's like hair of the dog when you've been drinking. So now this article here is from 2019, and I included it in here because this was the beginning of the bankruptcy procedure that just ended yesterday, the first article we talked about. So now you have, you know, almost 2,500 lawsuits under this one settlement, meaning that these lawsuits are being lowballed to an extreme. And the fact that there are 2,300, so many of them taken by government agencies, suggests that the destruction that this family has done. But you're right to say that now a doctor is going to be terrified to – I mean, assuming – see, I'm not sure what this is going to do to supply. This doesn't affect Vicodin. This is only Oxycontin, oxycodone with acetaminophen. Not sure about the supply now. Purdue grants the patents, I guess, or the permission to make a generic version. I don't know what this is going to do to supply, if this company is going to fall apart. But it doesn't matter either way, because I can't imagine doctors wanting to get involved in this and be named in a lawsuit if anything were to happen. It's not like the vaccines where you can't sue them at all. But that's what they're trying to go for here. Now, if these 2,300 lawsuits equal the amount that they have to pay, it's one thing. But again, we don't know how much these people are worth. They have money all over the place. How much of it can the bankruptcy court get its hands on? I don't know. And the other issue is, does it affect their personal wealth, which all comes from them? That I don't know. So they still have a lot of weapons at their disposal. And the thing is probably going to be appealed anyway.
I think addiction is when you have an unresistible urge to redose straight away after taking the last dose, and dependence is when you are dependent upon something, and that's the issue here. When people take opioids, they will become dependent on them, physically dependent on them. That's not the addiction side of it. The addiction side of it is continuing to redose and taking more and more and more so that you get high. And people can get addicted to chocolate. They can get addicted to sex. It's having to constantly do something all the time. Am I right in thinking that these pills, people crush them up and snort them? Is that right, Matt? Is that where this abuse potential comes in? Because it's supposed to be a slow-acting opioid, therefore it wasn't so addictive. Is it that people were crushing them up and snorting them and taking them that way?
Well, I think it depends on whether or not the pill is extended release or not. Extended release pills are coated, and your stomach gradually digests them, so it lets out a little bit at a time. If you want to, most of them that are prescribed aren't extended release. That's just a pill like any other pill. But if it is extended release, the only way to get out of it is to crush it. Well, I don't know if they snort them. I don't see the benefit of that, but to crush them and put them in a drink or something like that, I think that will negate the extended release factor. I think that's all that is. I'm not sure the chemistry of the thing, but I don't know. I've not come across the extended release version, although I'm sure it exists. It's usually more expensive. Insurance companies rather you not have it for that reason. So that's the only reason I think you would crush it up. But you know, again, that would completely negate the extended release factor. I don't know what they're doing. I'm just picturing them, you know, taking the pill. It's pretty fast acting to begin with. Snorting may increase the intensity, but the duration would be less. So I think there's all kinds of ways that they're doing this and adding things to it as well.
You have to really sort of hold the doctors responsible. I mean, all doctors know that opioids are dependency inducing, and for a pharmaceutical company to come out and say, oh, we've got an opioid that isn't dependency inducing, I mean, it's just an impossibility. Well, more than 20 years and 400,000 deaths after the debut of the devastatingly popular drug, it is a relief that authorities are finally getting around to holding some of the perpetrators responsible. Opioids kill more Americans every year than car crashes, and have single-handedly decreased the average US lifespan. However, the crisis is less due to especially evil schemes by those particular companies and more of the inevitable outcomes of a healthcare system where curing the patient pays less than keeping them coming back again and again. Opioid manufacturers and distributors merely took advantage of a corrupt and broken business model where pharmaceutical companies were able to collude with medical authorities to elevate pain to the level of a vital sign, alongside blood pressure, temperature, respiratory rate, and pulse, presenting their product as the only truly effective solution to the problem. When Purdue unleashed OxyContin on the market in 1996, they simply lied and claimed their product had an addiction rate in the single digits. The other companies followed their lead. By the time OxyContin was reformulated to make it less appealing to addicts, there were Vicodin, Lortab, and fentanyl waiting in the wings. Hand in hand with the American Academy of Pain Medicine, the American Pain Society, and other authoritative-sounding groups, Purdue seduced doctors with an irresistible 1-2 punch. First, they were told they were remiss in not checking all their patients for pain, the fifth vital sign. Then they were told that OxyContin is the only opioid painkiller that has managed to overcome the addictive factor, so they should overcome opiophobia and start writing prescriptions. Now, that's all fair and good until they then suddenly stop writing the prescriptions, and then suddenly you've got all these people dependent upon this OxyContin that are then going to go out and buy street drugs to compensate for it. I mean, that seems to me to be where the problem is. What are your thoughts on this, Matt?
Well, for one thing, you know, thank God for Kratom, which is a kind of imitates the action of certain opiates at a very, very low level. That's been effective at taking people off, you know, hydrocodone or oxycodone. So hopefully people would go to that rather than trying to get the same high from really a very similar drug, come from the same poppy plant in heroin, you know, any morphine derivative. So the other thing that I like here is, and this happens all the time, these billionaires create these academies. You know, the American Pain Society, this Academy of Pain Medicine. They staff them with very impressive doctors, and all they really are propaganda outlets. You know, these guys will, you know, if you're a research guy, get big salaries, very pompous sounding name, and you do what you're told. And doctors can be fooled by this kind of thing. They have conferences, and, you know, they make a big deal out of it, and they have the money. But again, I want to repeat, I've not come across any doctor that was at all happy to write a prescription for that. Doctors would rather have you suffer in many cases than do that. I think only in the most extreme cases will they write a prescription, and God knows what they're going to do now. There's a lot of doctors that have lost their license on the East Coast here because they were selling these prescriptions. And now the other thing, the fentanyl, of course, which is a synthetic variation of morphine, which is far more effective and more deadly because it takes just a little speck of it. Now, Vicodin is hydrocodone, which is slightly less potent, but it also has acetaminophen. Both of them have acetaminophen in it. So not only do you get addicted to the narcotic, but your liver gets shot with the massive doses of acetaminophen. There was a – talk about propaganda. One of my favorite shows from 10 years ago was House MD. It was played by the British actor Hugh Laurie, who was a brilliant doctor, genius in fact, who was totally addicted to Vicodin or hydrocodone. That was a central plot point to the entire series, was that he was making the brilliant decisions while popping Vicodin pills like they were Tic Tacs. I always wondered why they had that. Always wondered why his brilliance was unaffected or maybe even caused by his drug addiction. It was a hit show. I love the show. But I wonder if this has something to do with the propaganda of this company to make this genius a Vicodin addict. I don't see what other purpose that would serve. And I think so. Other places you have this propaganda of making this stuff seem not only harmless, but extremely positive for your mental state.
I think we're very lucky in Britain not to have these medicines advertised to us on the television. It does sort of prevent these sort of things from happening. Johnson & Johnson have also been in trouble over this. On Saturday, June the 26th, they agreed to pay $263 million to resolve claims that it fueled an opioid epidemic in New York State and two of its largest counties. The settlements removed the pharmaceutical company from a jury trial that started Tuesday, June 29th, on Long Island, New York. Several big opioid makers and distributors are also defendants in the case. Johnson & Johnson did not admit liability or wrongdoing in settling with New York State and with Nassau and Suffolk counties, but the $229.9 million settlement with the state also called for the company to stop selling the painkillers nationwide. New York Attorney General Letitia James said in a statement that the opioid epidemic has wreaked havoc across the nation and that Johnson & Johnson helped fuel this fire. James said her focus remains on getting funds into communities devastated by opioids as quickly as possible. Johnson & Johnson said the settlements were consistent with its prior agreement to pay $5 billion to settle opioid claims by states, cities, counties, and tribal governments nationwide. The company and the largest U.S. drug distributors, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, Inc., and McKesson Corp., have proposed paying a combined $26 billion to end thousands of opioid lawsuits. That sounds more like it, in the billions. I mean, I was looking at this $229 million settlement. That really doesn't sound like much for a company like Johnson & Johnson, but I think that's part of this larger agreement. Is that right, Matt?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a separate case. A little bit older, but I should note that in the Sackler case, or Purdue, the settlement also requires or does not require them to admit wrongdoing. That's the other problem that people have, and the same thing with Johnson & Johnson. Now, of course, what else does Johnson & Johnson make in this world? They're central in the COVID vaccine world, so here you have them fully in serious trouble for poisoning this country with these pills, promoting them beyond all reason and purpose, covering it up and all the rest of it, everything that they've been accused of here. And of course they accept it. They don't admit wrongdoing. It's sort of like a no contest plea in this sense. So these, again, they're the same people who are being defended by the Washington Post for the vaccine and how it's harmless. And on the other side, they're doing this and they're very much a part of this. So clearly the company has it in them. They've done this sort of thing before. They've done it with narcotics. They'll do it with the vaccine. The other thing to remember is that every penny that they've paid out has been made up for by the COVID vaccine. And yet it's a lot of money. It's a good thing. Depending on what they're going to do with it, there's a lot of earmarks where this money's going to go. But the COVID vaccine has completely negated it. They're now more profitable than ever.
And of course, once they take the oxycodone and the OxyContin away from these patients or addicts, then there's a market there, isn't there? That because they're still going to need this, even if the legal avenues to acquiring it have been taken away. And this is, of course, where the war in Afghanistan plays in. It was under the initial post-Taliban regime of President Hamid Karzai where drug exports began to surge as the very regime installed by the Bush administration shielded the unlawful trade from its cosmetic prohibition effort. Even though voter fraud was rampant during both the 2004 and 2009 Afghan elections, Karzai was championed as the country's first democratically elected leader while receiving tens of millions in behind-the-scenes payments from the Central Intelligence Agency. A long-time Western asset, Karzai had previously raised funds in neighbouring Pakistan for the anti-communist Mujahideen during the Afghan-Soviet war in the 1980s. Not only did the ranks of the Islamic Holy Warriors, armed and funded in the CIA's Operation Cyclone program, include Karzai and the eventual core of both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden himself, but it is also well established the jihadists were deeply immersed in drug smuggling as the US looked the other way. And of course, the Taliban did away with all the heroin production in Afghanistan, and as soon as the Americans went in there, it became responsible for something like 90% of the world's production of this. There was a huge increase in this. And I think the point you want to make is that that was basically covering all these people that had been stopped from getting their OxyContin from the doctor. And I think, you know, that's what causes these overdoses, is them not getting it from the doctor, but getting it from the street dealer. Matt, what are your thoughts on this and the Afghanistan connection?
Well, we couldn't have a show like this without the Afghanistan connection. The crisis itself, all the versions of morphine, hit roughly around the time of the American invasion. After the Soviets pull out, the warlords take over, heavy CIA influence, the heroin is everywhere. Taliban takes over, it goes down to zero. The UN fully admitted it, the drug agencies fully admitted it. They have a fatwa. It's death for anyone who has anything to do with it. This is a central core belief of the Taliban movement. And they make money other ways. But it was the worst kind of projection for the American media, the American government, to claim that, no, it's the Taliban that are making money off heroin, not us. Despite the fact that wherever the Americans went and their allies went, the poppy production was restored. It went, the heroin was difficult to get your hands on, at least from, Central Asia, back when the Taliban ran everything. And they subsidized farmers to get rid of the poppies and plant something else. And having a pistol in your back didn't hurt either. But that's what happens when you have a war-torn country like this. And so thank God the Taliban have taken over, because this is going to now be cut off as a source of drugs. I don't know if you're going to go to Mexico, Southeast Asia. It's going to be far more difficult to get this to market. But if it goes to Mexico, I guarantee you're going to see protection of some of these people, like the Americans were defending the Sinaloa cartel in Colombia. But Afghanistan, yeah, it's about 95% of the world's poppy production, and therefore the non-refined heroin is coming from there. And overwhelmingly, it's going to the illegal side of things. Now, I think the fentanyl concept, also the CIA was well aware that these people were making their money on drugs. So the media to talk about the Taliban, it was the most ridiculous. I mean, it's the worst kind of awful defense mechanism I've ever heard of before. It's pure projection. And the U.S. has admitted all that. The CIA has admitted all this. They pretended they didn't know. But this is where their money was coming from for a long time. The Taliban were taxing cross-border imports from Pakistan. That was their source, not to mention taxation. And they also have interest-free banking, so they didn't have to worry about a lot of debt. So, and of course, it's connected with Kosovo and Albania, which is the source into Europe. Russia has closed off their borders. I mean, in the Georgia area, which is why a pro-American government had to be installed there. This is how it is. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization has crushed these things. The Western world, the liberal world, has made sure it has a market. There's no war on drugs when everybody who gets arrested for it gets a lawyer. I don't remember Japanese soldiers getting a lawyer in Iwo Jima. That's not how a war works. The drug trade helped keep the American stock market afloat after 2008, 2007. And it's a big part of the American economy. It's laundered through major corporations. It's going to be very difficult for capitalism to deal with an Afghanistan that's not producing heroin anymore. They're going to have to go elsewhere, and it's going to get very messy and more expensive.
Well, it's interesting as well that the biggest opium producer, or the guy that was responsible for the province that was producing it all, was Hamid Karzai's brother. So, you have a family connection there between the puppet president that was put in by America and the biggest guy who's actually responsible for all the poppy production over there in Afghanistan. Of course, now, of course, it's all been stopped. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.